The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, we drop out with director Jamie Thraves. Jamie will be telling me about his film, Treacle Junior, which tells of a family man who simply ups and leaves to find himself in a bind on the streets of London. And from one unpredictable move to another, Bobby Fischer Against the World tells of the rise and fall of one of the world's greatest ever chess players. We'll be hearing from director Liz Garbus on why Bobby Fischer still beguiles people to this day. And helping me review some of the week's other releases, Sam Brooks joins me. We'll be looking at the end of the Harry Potter franchise in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, and Spanish cinemas in the slammer with Cell 211. It's a hack-free zone. It's Film Weekly. Jamie Thraves is probably best known for his cult Radiohead video for their song Just. Its enigmatic message still has not been deciphered, but his breakthrough as a feature filmmaker happened in 2000 with his film The Lowdown, a tale of friendship and love in London's East End, starring Irish actor Aidan Gillen. Best known now for his television work in series like Queer as Folk, The Wire, and most recently, HBO's Game of Thrones. This week sees the second collaboration between Gillen and Thraves with the release of Treacle Junior, a full decade after that success with The Lowdown. The story of Tom, played by Tom Fisher, who one day, in a split-second decision, leaves behind his wife and baby in a tasteful suburban home in Birmingham and heads for a life of a down-and-out on the streets of London. That's where he meets Aidan.
My name is Aidan, by the way, Aidan Murphy. Am I knowing you?
What?
Am I knowing you?
No, you're okay.
I am, I don't mind, you can say if I do.
No, you're not annoying me.
Oh, really? You're not just saying that?
No.
You're a nice man, Tom, I like you. It's a lovely day, isn't it? Which way are you going?
Which way are you going?
I don't mind, I'm easy. You know what I'd like right now? Hot bits.
Hot what?
Hot bits. Don't you just love the bits? The sun, the sea, the sand.
What, a beach? Beaches?
Yes, bitches. I can't even remember the last time I saw
that. Aidan and Tom go on to find their lives inextricably entwined. And joining me to tell more about his film is director Jamie Thraves. Welcome to Film Weekly, Jamie. Lovely to have you back on the filmmaking scene as well. I mean, I remember so freshly seeing The Lowdown and thinking, wow, this is great. He's going to make loads of films. He's going to be the new British New Wave led by Jamie Thraves. And here we are, a decade later. But it's nice to have you back.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Does it feel like a long time? Did much happen in that time that made you think, well, I'm still around?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was doing a great deal of work, but it's been 10 years since I've actually had a film in the cinemas in Britain.
Yeah.
So
it's a different feeling, isn't it?
The
stuff that I know you've done, Dizzy Rascal and Coldplay videos and things like that, but having a film out there, is it something special or it's just something different?
It's something special, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think every filmmaker's dream is to have your film in the cinema. It's great to have your film seen on the telly, don't get me wrong, or even on a mobile phone, you know, or whatever. But at the cinema, I mean, it's where you fell in love with cinema, isn't it, right? It's a bit of a dream.
Yeah. How much of this was kind of what you'd written down, and how much of it was because you've got two marvellous actors there in Tom Fisher and Aidan Gillen? In fact, my producer worked with Aidan Gillen a very long time ago in Dublin when they were 16 and 17. And I myself have worked with your other actor, Tom Fisher, many years ago as well. So a little bit of sharing before we go on here on Film Weekly. But, I mean, they are two. Always, I mean, Tom Fisher was always, he was the best actor of his generation, in my opinion, when we were at Oxford together. And I know Ben Hopkins has used him as well.
Right. Yeah.
And Aidan, I think, is, you know, just, was extraordinary the first time I ever saw him on screen, which was in Mojo, I think, for Jez Butterworth way back. You know, working with those two, but you yet keeping them tightly to a script that you had, or did they want to go off on their ideas?
We workshopped it together. Aidan and I go way back because of The Lowdown. We became very good friends. Then Aidan and Tom Fisher became friends on another film. They were working on Shanghai Nights, I believe. Jackie Chan.
The excellent Shanghai Nights.
Yes, indeed.
I thought, that's Tom Fisher's big moment. And he is kind of having to play Inspector, whatever it is, to Jackie Chan.
Well, Tom's been sidelined as a bit of a character actor. He's much more than that.
That was lovely to see him.
I think he's kind of like that. He's the English Paul Giamatti. I'm going to good plug for Tom Fisher. He really is. He's a fantastic actor, and he's been a bit sidelined on this film because Aidan's getting lots of attention, and he's what can I say? I mean, he's about to play Graham Chapman in the Monty Python.
Oh, he'll be brilliant.
Which is perfect. Cast.
Oh my God, I knew something would come along that's just right. Because you say he's Paul Giamatti, but the thing about Tom Fisher is he's taller than everyone else.
Yes, he's a tall Paul Giamatti type character. I think he can play leading roles, and he's got such a gentle, lovely quality about him. And that's why, I almost cast him in The Lowdown and then stayed in touch with him from that. And so it was weird how Aidan, Tom and I became friends, and we started going to gigs together and stuff, and we got the same sort of taste in music. I think we all just sat around and said, look, let's make a film together. I was desperate to make another film, obviously. Aidan and I had talked about this character for a long time. Aidan introduced me to this character about 10 years ago. And it just sat with me for years and years and years, thinking, always at the back of my mind, thinking that would make a good film.
So what did Aidan say when he got this character? Because I believe it's a character that Aidan is based on someone he knew.
It's inspired by someone. He's a Dubliner, and it's not his life. I think we sort of, but it's very much inspired by his optimism. I think more than anything. And that was the thing that drew me to the character. It's just the sheer optimism in the face of adversity.
Yeah, it's almost it's relentless, but it's also kind of you can't defeat it, really.
No,
it
really
knock down
is.
And get up again.
I know, and I was desperate to have that kind of optimism in my own life, I think. So I think I think I tend to make films that mirror my own life in some way. I shouldn't really say that, but it's like kind of like, I remember making The Lowdown, thinking this is a real sink or swim film, and then here I am 10 years later doing the same thing again.
But your lead character, apart from Aidan, who's this kind of, there's a savantish kind of element to him, except he doesn't kind of spout wisdom, but he has a kind of optimism that is, I suppose, is what sometimes kind of stands for savantism in like a Hollywood cheesy movie. But you've got Tom who literally, at the start of the movie, he's got this lovely baby, lovely house, lovely wife, gets on a train and he just seems to have had enough. I've just recently had a baby and I sort of, there's a couple of days I've got to say I know how he felt. And I noticed that you have, from the film credits, you've obviously got children, so they're in the film.
They're in the film.
Is this something that there was a moment that you've had it?
I think, I remember speaking when I was writing the script and sending the script out to people, and a few people were saying to me, oh, this is an AWOL fantasy script, story. And I spoke to other people about it. There's definitely those moments where you sort of, usually when you're in some sort of travelling mode, either in a car or on a train, where you just said, if I don't take this turning now to home, I could just keep on going up to Scotland or the Isle of Skye or something. Yeah. And or if I'm on a train, obviously end up going to... So, I mean, for this... And I think that... I think a lot of people identified with that idea. And this is the guy that actually does it that time.
Yeah. And you sort of... He does it rather beautifully as well, because he's obviously completely ill-equipped to do it as well, which I kind of like, that he doesn't just kind of immediately kind of get, completely roughed up. But it's a sort of gentle kind of... He's relying on the systems that I suppose nature, or the human nature and the system itself, this country provides. There's NA and E ward he can go and get sorted out. But then after that, he is lonely. Where does he go? What can he do?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted to put him through hell a little bit for doing that to his wife.
Yeah. He deserves it in a way.
Well, he does. And at the same time, it's not explained what's going on with him. Clearly, he's having some kind of breakdown. And it was a strong, it was a tough decision to avoid explaining it. But every time I tried to explain it in the script, it felt really clunky.
Yeah.
And felt like I was getting to the heart of some issue as to why he was going, it's like to do with an illness or it's to do with some kind of something that's gone on in his past. And I was kind of tired of that kind of backstory to just try and make people feel sorry for him or feel emotion.
You don't explain why Aidan is how he is either.
No, exactly. Well, there's a little bit more explanation with Aidan, but I felt like, why can't you just have sympathy for someone just because of their nature? Just on what you see. I mean, I feel incredible amount of love for Tom Fisher just in his demeanour, and I thought that was enough. I mean, and at the same time, I feel like people will watch that film. It probably will annoy some people. I know it does.
Yeah.
Get frustrate some people. But
I normally get annoyed by things like people like that at all. And I just didn't at all.
Okay. Mate,
and that I assume is the skill of all three of you kind of at work.
Oh yes.
Go together. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly yourself, James. But also, you mentioned tone, and something that struck me immediately from the first sort of opening shot was the music of this film, which I really liked.
I could.
I noticed it's a band called Stems.
A band called Stems. It's my
band. You're in it.
Stems,
I know,
yes.
Just at the end on the credits. What do you play?
I play guitar and sing on it and stuff. Yeah.
Right. It's much cheaper doing it.
Well, you know, my last film I made, which was the kind of film that sort of bridges the gap between The Lowdown and this one, which was never got seen.
No, I never seen it. It starred Paddy Considine.
That's right. It was it's a misunderstood piece of genius that never made it to the cinemas. It's a very odd film. And in talking about tone, that film's tone.
What's that one called?
The Cry of the Owl. It's based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. And I made it with BBC Films. And it took me 5 years to make. And it really did really take it out of me. And when it didn't get to the cinemas, it really almost broke me, I think.
Yeah. It went straight to BBC?
It went to DVD and then was shown on BBC Two not so long ago, actually. It has some hardcore fans.
It does. I read about it, but I didn't even know about it, which really upset me.
As a result of that film, I felt like, well, I'm not going to spend another 5 years making a film. I'm not going to go through development hell. So the only option I had, I mean, I could have perhaps found some money for this Treacle Junior, but I wasn't going to spend 2 years finding it.
Yeah, so where'd you get the money from?
Remortgaged my house to do that.
Really? People say don't ever do that.
They do say that, and it's probably true. But my sister Anne and her husband Nigel, they very kindly lent us some money as well. So we ended up with about 30,000.
Yeah, I mean, not to be rude, I'm not going to ask your age, but I'm going to say, how much do you need to make a film like this? Because it is, you know, it just looks that you've done it on the hoof, you use real locations, but how much do you really sort of need?
Well, I talked about it with my producer, Rob Small. I mean, Rob did a fantastic job on this in terms of what we just really broke it down and said, what is the minimum we can do this for? We couldn't pay anybody, obviously, but we felt the least we could do was pay for everyone's travel and food.
Yeah, it was a cup of tea.
The least decent thing you could do for anyone who's standing in the rain in September and October late at night. So, we made it for 30,000. But the film, really, with all the deferred fees, and I really, really hope to be able to pay these people back one day. I want to be one of the few films that has deferrals that actually pays people back.
Yeah.
It was all based on around 250 grand. Mm. So really the film should have cost 250 grand. So I kind of like, I'm talking about the money quite a bit because we're quite proud that we made it for that.
Well, I think you should be. Go shout it from the rooftops. If we can help on Film Weekly, we'll pass a little hat round like Tom Fisher looking for a cup of tea on the streets of South London. Jamie Thrace, lovely to have you back in the cinemas. Lovely to have you on Film Weekly. Congratulations on Treacle Junior. And Treacle Junior is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 15th of July. Now, from one odd couple to another, Zan Brooks joins me. This week we'll be reviewing Harry Potter, the last one, Cell 211. Zan, but we must start with Harry Potter, of course, because it is the end of Harry Potter. Do you experience some kind of delirium that this franchise that has dogged you so over the years has now come to an end?
Well, it was a very curious experience because I've spent like the last 10 years of my life, I think, trying to get into the Harry Potter films and feeling like an audience member in front of a particularly inept children's conjurer where they keep trying to make the magic work and you keep seeing the wires and the stage flats and thinking, those actors aren't talking to each other, they're reading from a script. And yet this one, belatedly, I felt myself kind of levitating. It was finally working.
I was watching this thinking, do you reckon I think even Zan might like this one? Before we find out why, let's have a little listen to the three of them, Emma Watson, Rupert Grint and Daniel Radcliffe.
I reckon he'll stop at nothing to make sure we don't find the rest. Oh, there's more. One of them's at Hogwarts.
What? You saw it?
I saw the castle and Rowena Ravenclaw. It must have something to do with her. We have to go there now.
What? We can't do that. We've got to plan, we've got to figure it out.
Hermione, when have any of our plans ever actually worked? We plan, we get there, all hell breaks loose.
He's right. One problem. Snape's headmaster now. We can't just walk through the front door.
There they go. I can't believe that even now, that it is 10 years, and now I can say things like Muggle and Gringotts and Voldemort, all things that I used to kind of go, well, I can't deal with anything that deals with Mordor and things, all that nonsense. Now they sort of trip off the tongue.
Yeah, it's certainly entered the consciousness, hasn't it?
And the lexicon, I think.
Certainly the lexicon. And, you know, I've always sort of thought before that these films, they're not going to survive the test of time. Mm. They're going to be... these sort of strange white elephants that occasionally crop up on afternoon TV, and your grandchildren will say, you know, do people really like this? But having seen this last one, I kind of think, well, maybe.
So what is it about this last one, the dotting of the I's, the crossing of the T's? What is it about this one? Is it simply because finally it all ends? I mean that there is a kind of, you know, there is a finite kind of tying of the knot.
Yeah, I think maybe there's been a sort of structural problem before now, in that it's all been exposition. It's all been like, oh, there's a secret book that will lead us to the next film. And you're thinking, oh, Jesus Christ, another one. So, but now you've got this sort of tipping point where you've been pushing this huge amount of baggage uphill for seven films. And now it kind of goes over the top and just rolls to the finish line, and does pick up speed and does have momentum. And it's a film that does have a grandeur to it, if not quite a majesty. It's certainly involving and exciting, and it's, you know, it's basically a, you know, Apocalypse at Mallory Towers.
It's pretty awesome. That kind of, I think we both agreed that the last one, the first part of this one, which I think was a huge misstep, dividing them into two. Yeah. I think it was cynical and horrible. It also took us away from Hogwarts. So the one thing that always worked for me about these films were the Hogwarts things. I mean, at least it happened in a locus, and it kind of was part of a kind of, I don't know, British tradition of school things, and it was almost a kind of riposte to American high school movies, of which we've imbibed so much culture over the years. It was quite nice to see this British stuff. Now we're back in Hogwarts, and things are kicking off. You know,
things are
rocking,
kicking, yeah.
In fact.
Yeah, and it does have the big sort of Lord of the Rings, you know, the Gates of Mordor kind of, you know, Armageddon battle, which I thought was very well done. Even the acting didn't bother me as much as it has done in the past. I think that there was some sort of heartfelt playing in there amongst all the amazing spectacle. What was interesting as well, coming on the back of last week's release of The Tree of Life, these weird parallels between these two very, very different films.
No, I think you've just been...
it's true. You've got like a key flashback involving nurturing, wonderful, ethereal, red-haired mum.
Yeah.
And you've also got a scene in the afterlife. Here it happens to be King's Cross Station.
Yeah, that's true. In white. Yes, it's
cool. So there you go.
I preferred it in Queen's Cross Station.
I think
to
I did.
Salt flats.
I think I did as well. And again, that's not something I'd ever thought I'd say.
I thought Maggie Smith, they all have a scene. I mean, in the way you say the nuts and the bolts and the magic, it was all quite sort of a piece, but I think it set its own world, Harry Potter, and stuck to it very well all the way throughout. I mean, I actually quite saw that, the first one again, that I wanted to see what it was like, to see how little the Christopher Columbus one, which I thought was rather a solid piece of work that set us going. And it does amaze me that they've gone 10 films, and fans of the book, I mean, how many books, everyone sort of says, well, it's never as good as the book. I mean, I think even fans of the books have sort of said the films are all right. To do it seven times is quite a feat.
I think the general consensus as well is that the last film, this one, is better than the last book, where Rowling had reached a point where, you know, she was too big to have an editor. So a lot of the kind of the structural problems maybe of the last book have been ironed out, certainly in this last bit of the film. And yeah, you're right. It has conjured up its own world that we live in and have come to know and to a large degree believe in. I think there's a world that is cobbled together from a lot of secondhand sources.
Oh, yeah. But that's her imagination,
but that's
not the film.
That's fine. So there's a bit that's, you know, it's a bit, obviously a bit Lord of the Rings in there. It's a bit kind of Enid Blyton doing the Borgias at times, with all this sort of skullduggery in sort of darkened corridors.
I'm always amazed that it's so successful, and yet it's clearly based on sort of private school kind of housemasters and all that
sort of
thing. And yet most people who see it probably don't go to private school. I mean, it's successful in American high schools, in, you know, eight schools across Asia and the Philippines and, you know, Australia, and it's also, you know, it's preceding state schools. I mean, it just strikes me that all these people, you know, I don't know how 10 years it's been, so how many education ministers we've had who've tried to come up with academies and free schools and community colleges and religious schools, faith schools. Anyone that's really been successful through that time is Hogwarts.
Well, that's another foundation of it, is this sort of weird heritage Britain, this sort of view of what English childhood is like that's peddled to the wider world. And of course, it's an English childhood that, you know, the private school thing, what's that, 7% of people, and the magical private school is, you know, probably even less than that. There was also kind of weird aspects to this, felt like early 80s kind of, you know, Cure videos and things like that. There's a lot of kind of beautiful wafting grey ghost in the sort of mansions, and you kept thinking you're going to have this kind of goth rock kind of soundtrack.
Yeah, Bonnie Tyler was going to burst. I really need you tonight.
Yeah.
But she didn't. I missed her.
And I mean that in a kind of pleasing way.
Yeah,
it was fun.
Well, strangely enough, we both really like that final Harry Potter.
It's far and away the best one.
It is, actually, as well. HP7. Kevin. Well done. Zan, we heard from the director, Jamie Thraves, just before about his film Treacle Junior. I, in that interview, I obviously sort of said that I was very fond of it. Just wondered if you were too.
I was. I liked it a lot. You know, Jamie Thraves obviously did The Lowdown 10 years ago and then disappeared. And I had the same feeling that I had with The Lowdown, that you think, this is a real recognisable London that we're seeing here. We've just talked about Harry Potter. How it peddles a completely false view of Britain, and that's fine as far as it goes. But there's definitely a need, certainly in me, for a kind of London and an England that I kind of recognise. And I guess it comes back to the Hitchcock line about cinema being life with the boring bits cut out.
Yeah.
But that's a very dangerous, slippery slope, because a lot of times people will equate boring with what's real. And kind of weeded out. Some of it didn't feel entirely real. Some of it felt a little bit workshopped, which is maybe a problem for the low-budget film that you're kind of making up.
It was, he admitted in the interview, workshopped.
Yeah, but within that, I thought the performances of Tom Fisher and Aidan Gillen were absolutely superb.
Super. It was nice to see normal play, like Peckham Library.
Exactly, yeah, all of that.
Rather than some Hogwarts library, which has kind of got moving bookshelves.
Yeah, goblins behind every shelf. And, you know, it's a sort of bittersweet, odd couple drama, like, you know, it's a sort of London Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah, I liked it very much. Yeah, good. I'm glad you did. And Treacle Jr. is a cat, by the way, just in case why he was called Treacle Jr. It's named after a cat.
Yeah, he's an expert mouser who the Aidan character takes around cafes and sort of blunders in saying, this cat will catch all your mice, which doesn't endear him.
No, he gets him beaten up, indeed. Watch Treacle Jr., we're liking it very much. Did you see Cell 211?
I didn't, but I'm a great fan of the actor Louis Tosar.
Yes, one of the great names of European cinema. Him and Fanny Ardant.
They should get together, shouldn't they?
Together at last. Yes, I'm a fan of Louis Tosar. In fact, he won the best Goya. He won eight Goyas, this film.
Yeah, and I think he won Best Actor at the European Film Awards
for this as well. Because you're a
visitor. I do go to that, yeah, even when I haven't seen the film.
Yes.
¿Y si me tiene un ring? ¿Esa sangre?
Una hostia que me dieron.
Así que los señores funcionarios te dieron de hostia nada más llegar.
He plays in this. He plays a sort of ringleader of a prison riot, a kind of bruiser called Mala Madre, with it tattooed on his there's an infiltrator, a guard on his first day at work, gets caught up in this prison riot and has to pretend that he's actually an inmate, otherwise he's going to get duffed up by Mala Madre and his mates. And he does it rather well. He actually becomes a sort of ringleader in the riot. So the people who are watching on the screens in the closed circuit TV, they don't know whether he's part of it or whether he's kind of turned to the bad. How's he going to survive? It's a rather smart little kind of thriller. It's got elements of a Prophet in
there. Yeah, I was thinking,
kind of mixed up, kind of all this different. There's the Colombians in that bit, and then all sort of Spanish-speaking kind of people. Then there's the ETA terrorists in another cell that become kind of a blue-chip bargain into it. And Tosar is pretty good in it. To me, I think he's a bit more of a... It's a bit like someone like Ralph Fiennes trying to do The Psycho when he's
right, in
which they can do it, but they're not
but
really...
But you still have the whiff of Rada about
them. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think he'd rather be doing, you know, Lorco or something. But he's quite good in it, Louis Tosar. And it's very stylish done. Eight Goyas is quite a lot of Goyas.
And it is,
like,
isn't
it's
it?
Like, obviously the Spanish loved it. And it, I don't know, it's like when we have a British...
It's so
quite
it's like their
budget.
King's Speech.
Yeah, in a way, it is. rather tougher. But it's unusual to see that in Spanish cinema as well. So it is kind of that gritty kind of American thing going on. So Cell 211, I enjoyed it immensely, actually. Cell 211. It's called Cell 211 as well. Don't go around calling it Cell 211 and everything. Officially called Cell 211 or Celda 211.
It's like poetry.
Thank you very much. What have you seen that I haven't? Oh, you've seen the Turkish film.
I've seen the Turkish film, Bal.
Bal.
Which means honey. And it's the...
It doesn't mean honey, though, does it?
Apparently it does.
Oh, okay.
It means honey.
Right.
For the purposes of this podcast, it means honey, and it's the third in a trilogy.
Really? I haven't seen any of them.
Egg and milk. Seriously.
You're serious?
Seriously. I haven't seen egg or milk.
Right, we'll have a cake by the end of all this.
Well, flour is the fourth part that's coming soon.
Oh, yes, akşam gününde. Acıkımı gezeceğim. Ayaklarımın altında nemli serin kırlar.
This is this won the Golden Bear at the Berlin Film Festival this year.
I thought that was a Separation that won that.
No, or was it last year?
I think it was 2010.
2010. Okay. Well, it's belatedly reaching us now, and it's you know, better late than never because it's very good. It's set on the Black Sea coast. It's a sort of coming of age tale. And then you've got this six-year-old kid called Yusuf, who's a sort of lonely, soulful kid with a very bad stammer, whose father works collecting wild honey from the trees. So he goes off into nature, and then one day he does not come back. It's I always go into films like this with a slight prejudice because I kind of feel it's like sort of pornography for the middle class latte drinking.
Let's look at some poor people.
Let's look at some sort of beautifully shot poverty.
And then go on holiday there.
And go on holiday and stay in a 5-star hotel.
Yeah.
Let's have the sort of the soulful, beautiful child that we can kind of ogle.
That's a staple of European
it's
cinema.
Very
from
much a staple.
Collier to Cinema Paradiso.
Yes. But this is better than that. It has a sort of heartfelt quality to it. And I guess it's a film about how we're kind of stitched into nature and into the family unit, but about how these things are sort of precarious and changeable. And in the end, we're kind of on our own. And it's a great performance from an actor called Burak Altas as the 6-year-old Yusuf.
Turkish cinema, I sort of know it through Nuri Bilge Ceylan at the moment. That's the guy we normally see, and we enjoyed his Once Upon a Time in Anatolia that was in Cannes very much. Is this in a similar vein?
Not really. This is much warmer. Much more conventional, I guess. It's not a sort of rigorous art movie like the kind that Nuri Bilge makes.
It was quite popular in Turkey itself.
I think it probably was, yeah. And I would recommend it. I thought it was great.
Bal, Honey by, what's the name of the director?
The director is called Semir Kaplanoglu.
Oh, right.
And please don't make me pronounce that again.
No, I shan't.
Because I'm sure I didn't get it right.
I just want to make sure of that. So we've got Harry Potter 7, Cell 211, and Bal, and Treacle Jr. All quite good films, really.
It's actually a very good week, isn't it?
It's quite a strong week. You think, well, there's not there. Everyone's scared of Harry Potter. But actually, there's some good counter-programming on there as well.
There is. And, you know, when I was coming into this week looking at the schedule, I was thinking, you know, Harry Potter's by far and away going to be the worst one of that list. And yet it stands proud alongside Treacle Jr. So, you know, I'm sure they can put that on the poster.
British cinema in all its glory. Yeah, Harry Potter 7 and Treacle Jr. Zan, lovely to see you again. For all of Zan's writings and the best film reviews and news on the web, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Also this week, and Zan, thank you very much, you've been speaking to the US director, Liz Garbus, about her documentary, Bobby Fischer Against the World.
I'm going to stick a knight here. If he takes it off, he takes the bishop. So he took it off this bishop. And he's threatening this pawn. I don't think he took his right away. I guess he played here first. Now he took the bishop.
Bobby Fischer is one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest chess player in the world.
And now he took the rook.
Liz Garbus's acclaimed documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World charts the rise and fall of a chess genius. It shows us Bobby Fischer's turbulent, itinerant childhood in New York, his classic 1972 tussle against the Russian champion Boris Spassky, and the mental illness that came to blight his lengthy and often controversial retirement from the game. I spoke to director Liz Garbus from New York and started by asking her what it was exactly that made Fischer such a key figure, not just in chess circles, but in the wider world at large.
I think it was the Cold War that made him a key figure. I think that there's, you know, the conditions that produced Bobby Fischer's historical and cultural importance probably could never be repeated, because it was the Cold War, and it was the way that the Soviets had dominated chess and used chess as a sort of a demonstration of their intellectual superiority over the rest of the world. And here came this American kid. America had never taken chess so seriously. And then all of a sudden, here he was, unbeatable, formidable. And this became a matter of national pride. Mm. So he is, you know, he is a product, you know, he is, of course, an individual, highly complex, but he's also a production of the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, chess now, or possibly even then, is kind of generally regarded as this cerebral elitist exercise, and yet the Fischer-Spassky games were like these kind of mainstream blockbuster entertainments, and you say that he had greater name recognition than everybody except Jesus Christ at some point.
Right, right. And that, whether or not we could fact check that, and you know, but it was certainly the feeling of the time, right, that this was the man who was representing the entire free world. And in the Soviet Union, actually, he was very, very popular, and people were hanging on to the game. And Spassky was not as such a popular figure in Soviet culture in the way that some of the former chess champions had been. He wasn't a member of the Communist Party. He didn't really play the game exactly as they wanted to. So Bobby really took on this kind of great social importance and centrality in the public imagination. And frankly, he kind of exhibited all this kind of rock star tendencies. I think that's one of the things that people really forget, because we remember maybe this old man arrested in 2005 with a big beard. It's even for those people who followed the match, it's probably easy to forget that, you know, Bobby was this handsome, athletic young man who would go sit on the talk shows and have a laugh. And I think that's the part of him that people have probably forgotten.
What kind of opposition did you encounter when you were making this film? Were kind of old friends and associates willing to talk about him, or there's still a kind of guarded nature about how to deal with this very kind of complex, sometimes kind of ugly figure?
Yeah, well, both. I mean, there were certainly those people, because Bobby himself was press-averse and did not like his friends speaking to the press. Bobby, because he wanted to control his story, there were certainly friends who were wary of us, in the same way that Bobby probably would have been wary of us. Mm. And then there were many who understand that Bobby was a public figure who was sort of a part of a huge social and political moment, and also understand that Bobby was sort of complex, and his relationship to the press was not always a sane one. So they were sort of forthcoming, but they definitely were in two camps.
Was there still a kind of a loyalty towards him that you picked up on, even with all of the sort of the rabid anti-Semitism that sort of colored his sort of long retirement?
Well, I would say that I'd answer that question in two ways. First, in terms of loyalty towards him, I'd say for the general chess world and people in the chess world that we spoke to, or friends of his or associates from his in the past, it wasn't so much a loyalty as a wish for there to be respect for what he had accomplished, as opposed to simply writing off the crazy man who the public came to know later on. For chess players, Bobby changed the game of chess forever, especially for American chess players. Now chess was a game that, you know, demanded a significant purse. Now chess was, you know, of course it never regained that fame as it had in 72, but it really, he thrust chess into the national spotlight in this country. So people, they say his demands, they were seen as arrogant and unreasonable at the time, but in fact they paved the way for other chess players to really do this as a professional sport. And then on the other hand, there were those people, especially people in Iceland, who were around Bobby at the end of his life, who were very, I'd say, probably somewhat blindly protective of him, and wanting to kind of ignore the rabid anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, which was really not so much an organized ideology like a terrorist group might have, but were really just the rantings of somebody who was suffering from paranoid psychosis.
Yeah.
And to ignore that or to write it off is actually to not treat the individual who's suffering from them. And I'd say that there certainly were people at the end of his life who were in that camp who wanted to sort of say, no, none of this stuff is crazy. Bobby is well, which was actually doing a service to nobody.
Mm. We see the great Garry Kasparov in the film talking about the links between chess genius and mental illness, which I suppose it's a kind of chicken or the egg debate. But what's your own view, having made this film? Do you think that it was chess that kind of nudged Bobby Fischer in the wrong direction, or was it his sort of incipient illness that kind of led him to the chessboard in the first place?
You know, of course, there was no easy answer to this question. I think in a certain way, chess is what kept Bobby sane. I mean, I think that his entire life since the age of six had been organized around this single pursuit, and as long as he had this goal in mind, becoming world champion, everything was working towards that. Everything has meaning. I think after that goal was achieved, and he put it off, you know, many times, he could have become world champion younger. He just actually, you know, didn't show up at certain matches that he, as you know, in 1972, he almost didn't play, and there were matches before that where he, in fact, did not play. So I think chess kind of kept Bobby very organized, and I think it was after he no longer had that goal that Bobby began to feel lost, and I think that the sort of mental illness could fully sort of take over his wonderful mind. You know, he sought ideology from a church, you know, that could have filled the space in his life, but then he was, you know, became very disappointed in that church, and he never really found anything else that could fill that mental space for him.
What's your own view of him, having made this film and kind of lived in his shoes for a bit? Do you have sympathy for him?
I certainly have a lot of empathy for Bobby. He is someone, like I said, who is not, while he did have, say, I'm Jewish and I'm American, and while he did, we did listen to 200 hours of Bobby spewing anti-American and anti-Semitic ideology, we also, it became very clear to me that this was sort of a train going without brakes, that this was not a man who was in the full possession of his faculties, and that there was really nobody in his life who could intervene, who was strong enough, or that he allowed to be strong enough to kind of intervene in his life. So I certainly felt empathy. He clearly is a person who was capable of great feats and really had too short a career.
Well, Liz, it's a truly terrific film about a fascinating subject.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thanks to Zan and director Liz Garbus. Bobby Fischer, Against the World, gets a limited release here in the UK from Friday, the 15th of July. And that's all for this week. At the moment, The Guardian are doing research into how and why you listen to our podcasts. So we're very keen to hear your views on what we do. If you'd like to take part, all you've got to do is email us with your contact details, film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is the delightful little score to Treacle Junior by the band Stems, featuring our man Jamie Thraves, as you heard earlier. Finally, pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for the best film news and reviews, and my trailer trash column, of course, it's back. But from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.